Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media doesn't want you to explore. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after the Deep State. I want to bring on my friend Scott Horton. Scott is a well-known libertarian author, and he recently started the Scott Horton Academy of Foreign Policy. He's also one of the smartest people I have ever known. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, John. Thank you for having me. I'm one of the what kind of people you ever known?
You are one of the smartest, best arguing, best informed people I've ever known.
Okay, well, you're a liar then. I don't ever trust you CIA guys, really.
No, I'm serious. And I want to ask that, with that in mind, the first question. What do you think triggered the Trump administration's military actions against Iran? I've been of the belief that this all goes back to the Israelis, and Benjamin Netanyahu and previous Israeli prime ministers have begged a succession of American presidents to attack Iran. They all refused until this president. The JCPOA was working. Donald Trump withdrew from it, and the next thing you know, we're at war. But then you hear neocons saying that, no, it wasn't the Israelis, that the administration really believed that the Iranians were building a nuclear weapon of some sort. They were enriching uranium to the point where it was going to be used in a nuclear weapon. That was not the CIA's assessment. What do you think? Why are we in this current situation?
Well, look, I mean, they're just lying. They're always lying. Nuclear weapons program in Iran is a red herring. It always has been, you know, a pretext for war, essentially. I'll tell you what, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State and advisor to the President for National Security Affairs, he says, well, you know, Iran, they had 60% enriched uranium. And the only countries that have 60% enriched uranium have nuclear bombs. Wait, what? You see what he's doing there? Like, the reason he can't construct that as an actual, you know, sentence and a coherent thought is because he's bluffing, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's making nuclear weapons out of 60% enriched uranium. Nobody ever has. It is theoretically possible, but it would be a humongous, undeliverable, and unworkable type system. The only time anyone's ever made nuclear weapons out of uranium, they're above 90%, or I guess 80% at Hiroshima. But every other time after Hiroshima has been 90% enriched uranium-235 is weapons grade uranium. And why didn't they, John, go ahead and keep enriching up to 90% weapons grade?
They could have.
Why do they stop at 60? That's the question Marco Rubio's not trying to address there. And the answer is, because it was still a bluff. It was just they were raising the stakes of their bluff. The whole point of the Iranian nuclear program was as a latent nuclear deterrent against the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it went like this, basically. The Israelis are saying to the United States, bomb them. They can't be allowed to have a civilian nuclear program at all. Bomb them, regime change them, prevent that. Because for them to have a nuclear program is just really essentially covers only a stage in a nuclear weapons program. They've mastered the fuel cycle. They're going to make bombs, and then they're going to nuke us with them, and so can't be allowed. The Americans' position, this is under Bush, Obama, Trump 1, and Biden, was if you make a nuke, or if you break out and begin to try to make a nuke, we will bomb you before you finish, before you accomplish that. So don't you do it. And then the Iranians' position was, we're not making a nuke, so don't you bomb us. And if you bomb us, we might make a nuke. Now, they never said that part, but come on, let's not be naive here. They had mastered the fuel cycle. They had proven that they knew how to enrich uranium. And what they were saying was, if you attack us, then we might feel like we have no choice. This is what you call a latent deterrent or a threshold deterrent. It's the same as Germany, Japan, and Brazil. They can make nuclear weapons, but they're not making them because no one's threatening them right now, and they don't want to disrupt and destabilize their regions by making nukes when right now they don't feel like they really need them. And so same thing. here, the Ayatollah, the old dead Ayatollah's idea was, or the recent dead Ayatollah, not the old one, the recent dead Ayatollah's position, implied position was, if you attack us, then we might. So don't you attack
don't
us.
Attack.
That was the standoff, and it had held. All Obama's JCPOA did was just add an extra layer of security here. Mm-hmm. Because Iran had been a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty all along. Mm-hmm. And they had a safeguards agreement with the IAEA, where they continued to verify the non-diversion of nuclear material to any military purpose, as the IAEA does with all non-nuclear weapon states that have civilian nuclear programs. And so what Obama's treaty did really was, it wasn't really exactly a treaty, but what the JCPOA did was it expanded the inspections regime and it rolled back the program in significant ways. Now, well, just to be clear real quick, they turned Fordo from a production facility to just a research facility.
Right.
They scaled back the number of centrifuges spinning at Natanz by 2/3. They poured concrete into their Arak heavy water reactor, which is the reactor that had the capability of producing weapons-grade plutonium as a waste product. But they took that completely offline, and which it wasn't even online at the time, but they precluded the possibility that would be by pouring cement into the damn thing. And then they expanded their inspections regime to include even non-nuclear sites where Israel and America at least were pretending to believe, or maybe they had some trace evidence to believe that something was going on there that they wanted to inspect, like at Parchin and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they expanded the inspections regime, rolled back the program, and then in exchange, they got some of their own money back that Jimmy Carter had stolen back in 1979 during the revolution, money that they had paid for arms that they never got.
Right.
And then some sanctions relief that America never lived up to. So it really was not that bad of a deal. But Trump did have a point, though, John, in saying that, yeah, but there's all these sunset provisions where these restrictions expire soon. And those were major flaws. But did he try to address those flaws and say, now listen here, Ayatollah, I don't like Obama and I don't like this deal, but instead of tearing it up, it is America did sign the deal, even if it was Obama that signed it. So, but let's improve it. I don't like these sunset provisions. Let's do that. And he could have tried, and I believe he would have been very successful, quite frankly. He's obviously a much tougher act to deal with than Barack Obama from the Ayatollah's point of view. So, hey, lift the sunset provisions, fine. They were trying to settle for a latent deterrent anyway, right? Then, as you said, it was Netanyahu that convinced Trump to tear up the deal. Why? Just to raise the stakes, to make war more likely. Because a diplomatic solution that allows Iran to continue having enrichment at all is a red line to the Israelis, yes, whether it is to the Americans or not. And so the entire Israeli mission was to get Donald Trump to accept that line. And in fact, if you listen to Joe Kent, when Joe Kent says that it was the Israelis that convinced Trump to do this, that put all this pressure and made him do it, essentially, he's not really saying, at least firsthand, the Marco Rubio scenario, where Rubio said, this is a different Rubio quote now, this is where Rubio said, well, we had to do the war because Israel was going to start it and give us no choice, because if Israel started the war, Iran would then definitely hit back at American targets in the Gulf, and then we'd be dragged into it. And we decided not to do that. We would go ahead and start it with Israel so that we determine the time and the place and the whatever. So Joe Kent is actually not making that position, or he is, but only from the news. He's not claiming to know that firsthand the way that Rubio is. And I'm actually pretty dubious about that story, because I don't think that's really it. I think it's much more like the part that Joe Kent does say correctly, that he knows firsthand, is the same thing that we're talking about here, is that Netanyahu convinced Trump to adopt the Israeli position, mm-hmm, that a civilian program at all, or at least civilian enrichment at all, is the same thing as making a nuclear bomb. And the way Donald Trump talks, he's just like Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, where he's willing to lie about anything, and he just will conflate it together or whatever. It's, oh, they were 2 weeks away. They have a nuclear weapons program. We can't let them have a nuclear weapon. They wouldn't even promise not to make nuclear weapons. It's just, he's just lying his ass off about all, yeah, of these things. And it goes to show probably he doesn't even really understand much about it at all.
Yeah.
But he was convinced by Netanyahu that this is the line, and that if you don't stop them now, they will get nukes and they will use them. And that'll be your great failure. And the other side is you can stop them. And I think there must be, John, a national intelligence estimate in Israel that says, just flatter him. Right? And then that's it. Right?
I think that's right, Scott. I think that's right. There have been two national intelligence estimates in the United States. And a national intelligence estimate is a sense of the entire intelligence community. So all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies agree literally on every line. And when they're coordinated, they go line by line by line. It takes weeks usually to coordinate these papers. But all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies concluded twice that the Iranians did not have a nuclear weapons program. They just did not.
Right. And in fact, I can do better than that because your co-author, the great Gareth Porter, in y'all's book that y'all wrote about Iran and the bomb, he has his own separate book that he wrote before that.
Yes.
Called Manufactured Crisis. And in both books, y'all talk about in the later book, and he does in the first one, how even the CIA's conclusion and the rest of the intelligence agency's conclusion that Iran was even pursuing the designs and studying the possibility of a nuclear weapons system back before 2003 is wrong. And that, in fact, it was based on one half DIA intercepts that they were not lying, but they just fairly misinterpreted as, you see what they're doing? These are all dual-use items that could be used in a secret nuclear program. Mm-hmm. But then later, the IAEA verified where all those dual-use items were being used for their civilian purposes that they were ordered for in the first place. And so legitimate suspicions allayed. Sorry, canceled. That's a zero. And then the other half of it was the Israeli-forged so-called smoking laptop or laptop of death, which they pretended was an Iranian scientist laptop that they smuggled, that was smuggled out of Iran, when in fact it was the CIA's laptop, and all the information on it was concocted by the Israelis. It was totally forged by the Israelis and was funneled into the intelligence stream by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq communist terrorist cult, otherwise known as the MKO or the NCRI. And these were the kooks that funneled it into the intelligence stream in the first place. So there's the other half of the National Intelligence Council's estimate that they were even looking at nuclear weapons before 2003. And then I thought it was interesting, though, that they did conclude that then they even quit looking at it because America got rid of Saddam Hussein for them. And that was their only real concern, that that was their only real enemy that an atomic bomb could deter.
Yes.
When, again, America and Israel would attack them before they were finished making one, or they would have no ability to deliver one to Israel or certainly the United States. They wouldn't be able to deter America's H-bomb program with a couple of little Hiroshima-sized gun-type nukes or something, right? So the whole thing, if they needed one at all, it was in case America hired Saddam Hussein to invade them again, like Jimmy Carter did in 1980. And so, but then America took care of that problem for them. And at that point, according to the CIA, that they got the intercepts of everybody saying, like, you know, we are not looking at weaponization at all, just at electricity and whatever. And they concluded firmly. And then we know that there was, and they actually, it was funny because I actually found an old article that I wrote from like 2009 saying, release the NIE. And it was 2 years before they released the NIE, but we already knew it was in it. It was already reported what was in there. And then they have, as you say, they have reaffirmed that repeatedly since then, that they have not made, as the intelligence agencies put, they have not made the political decision to begin to make a nuke. Okay, but so now this brings us up to last June. Now, last June, Trump and Netanyahu called their bluff. They said, you know, they went ahead and bombed them, and they did not completely destroy Fordo and Natanz, but they did essentially put them off limits. They buried everybody alive down there if anybody was down there, and they bombed all the elevator shafts and the air vents and whatever, and they encouraged the Iranians to go ahead and seal off any other entrances, I guess in case Americans would try to, they try to drop the 82nd in there to go down into the tunnels. So they blocked all the entrances with giant boulders and whatever, and so all intelligence estimates, again, open source and according to Tulsi Gabbard, the DNI, they have not even begun to try to reopen Natanz, Fordo, or Isfahan at all.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So many different places to go on this. We've got the prospects for U.S. ground troops in the region. We have the change in policy between foreign policy between the United States and its Gulf allies, because the United States hasn't been able to protect its Gulf allies. But let me turn to Russia and China. In what ways do you think this U.S. military policy toward Iran has turned former allies like Iran and Russia into adversaries through covert actions or through NATO expansion? And do you think that the U.S. has an active program to try to drive a wedge between Iran and Russia, Iran and China, Iran and India?
Yes, I don't know how effective any of it is. I mean, it seems like every single thing that they do backfires, although, you know, that's obviously my observation bias from the way I'm coming from here. But you're, I'm sure, familiar with that important Rand Corporation study from 2019 called Extending Russia. And this has been cited by people who, like me, argue that America did a lot to provoke the war in Ukraine. And so what they mean even by that title, extending Russia, what they mean is overextending Russia, right? Extending Russia to the point that it is detrimental to Russia, all the extending that they're doing. That's the whole point of it. And then, of course, that means provoking Russia into overextending. That's what the study is about. How do we get them to overcommit to things that they cannot afford to do? How can we find ways to drive up their costs? And so one thing would be to put all the pressure that we can to prevent the completion of the Nord Stream pipeline. Another one was we could try again to overthrow the government of Belarus, which in fact they did the next year in 2020 and failed again for the third time since 2001. They said we could foment a crisis or even try to do a coup in Kazakhstan, which is Russia's Mexico, right? There's the biggest of all the stands on their southern border there, the most important of all the stands to Russia by far. We could increase support to the jihadists in Syria and start that dirty war back up again. And we could increase support to the government and the military of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And that would drive up Russia's costs in Eastern Europe there. But here's the joke is, and I encourage everybody to go read this. It's really a very instructive little piece of national security state literature, right? Extending Russia at rand.org. And what they say in there is every one of these insane recommendations, it'll say disclaimer. I think it is even in bold, disclaimer. And then at the bottom, they say, don't listen to us, man. If you do this, it'll be terrible. Here's all the stuff that'll happen. If we help the jihadists in Syria, they could take over Damascus and we would have a bin Ladenite state in Damascus. Then what the hell are we going to do? If we pour aid into Ukraine, that might provoke the Russians into actually sending their infantry and their armored divisions in and conquering the east of the country. Again, this is 2019. If we, foment uprisings in Kazakhstan, well, that could lead to whatever. I forgot their warning there. But what they're saying is, one, yes, they want to hit Russia from 15 different angles, and they want to force Russian overreaction in as many places as possible to drive up their costs. Mm-hmm. While at the same time warning that, geez, you know, we do tend to have the reverse Midas touch when it comes to this stuff, and everything that we do here carries tremendous risk. So you could add, and it might even be in there, try to separate Iran from Russia. But then what are we doing, right? We forced Russia to be dependent on Iran's drone capacity in at least the early years of the war in Ukraine. And now we're making Iran presumably dependent on Russia's friendship in terms of intelligence and perhaps military equipment. I know the Chinese have been flying in cargo planes full of God knows what to resupply the Iranian forces now. So I think the American strategic planners are not geniuses, and I think they mostly succeed in driving their enemies into each other's arms and making them more and more powerful.
Yes,
against
without any question. In fact, I wanted to ask you about that next. What role does blowback play in all this? This is one thing that has stuck with me throughout my adult life. At the CIA, one of the things I learned, Scott, was that it's easy to invade a country. It's easy to overthrow that country's leadership. It is almost impossible to be able to extricate yourself from that country once you've invaded it and you've overthrown the leadership. That's what blowback is all about. What does blowback look like in this context for the United States? How does the United States get out of Iran? And what would victory look like for the United States? Is victory, can there be victory short of installing a pro-US, maybe even pro-Israel regime in Tehran?
No, I mean, and that's a absolutely like preposterous magic wish that is never going to come true, right? Even with a World War II level effort, we're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So just, and we're not going to do that. So the very best case scenario right here is, I think, even forget talks, because we're not going to get what we want out of talks. There are too many counter incentives. Their 10-point plan versus our 15-point plan, I don't know, man. You know, maybe somebody break out a real long peace pipe, but I just cannot see that happening at all. The most talented Swiss ambassador can't stitch that together. So, but that sucks, though, because the other answer is also untenable to anyone else's ears, maybe, but yours and mine, which is just quit. Captain, fly home. Admiral, sail home. That's it. It's over. We're not doing this anymore. And then just completely disengage. And then at that point, shifts the entire burden on Iran to then figure out how they're going to get along with the rest of Eurasia from here on out without us. And after all, we are way over here in North America. Our national debt is $40 trillion. This catastrophe is the perfect time to just call it quits on the entire world empire. It would have been nice if somebody could have figured out a nice way to tie up all the loose ends, but no, they can't. And so it's, to me, a perfect time to just stop. And then Iran, look, I think it's essentially unavoidable, right? That short of dropping H-bombs on the place, they are going to emerge from this war. They already have emerged from this much of the war in a much stronger position. And, you know, there's two things there. You know, blowback is all the consequences, especially the long-term consequences. There's also this ridiculous martial overconfidence where, and I swear, like, I don't know, man, but this has got to be chapter one of your opening textbook in Army officer school, right? Is that tactics and operations are not strategy. Just because you can blow something up doesn't mean that you could determine the future of the course of all decisions that get made after you blow something up. And this is the story of our entire lifetimes here. I mean, certainly in this century, you have America going up against absolutely helpless enemies like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Gaddafi's Libya, the Taliban's Afghanistan, and then we're absolutely and completely unable to determine consequences. And you can even compare the three of those as like light in Libya, medium in Afghanistan, and heavy in Iraq, presence by American forces in the outcome. And in all three cases, we have nothing but catastrophe. Yeah. We broke Libya into three warring nations with slavers and bin Ladenites in charge of parts of it. In Afghanistan, we try to prop up a coalition of ethnic minorities against the ethnic plurality of the country for 20 years and then lost. And in Iraq, we fought an 8-year civil war for Iran's best friends from Skiri and Dawa and put them in power in a massive strategic own goal against our own side there. Yeah. And when they said, Muqtada al-Sadr, stop being friends with Iran or we'll shoot you, he said no. And he's still, and in fact, he was the least Iranian tied of all the Shiite leaders there, and he's closer to Iran than ever before, and he's still one of the most powerful kingmakers in the country to this day. So these people, does anyone, hell, you're a former CIA analyst and officer here, do you or anyone that you've ever experienced in your professional life doubt that America could put firepower on targets and explode things and kill people? No one doubts that. But the question is, can you make the politics in the place that you're trying to influence do what you want to do, right? Isn't that the Clausewitz thing about war is politics by other means? Are we waging war simply on a tactical and operational level just to get rid of inventories and replenish them again? Or are we actually trying to achieve any strategic goals here? Because if you're looking at Iran, all the strategic planners always said that we have a way to start this war, but we don't have a good way to end it. We can set back their program, but that just incentivizes them to make weapons. We can kill their Ayatollah, but then they're just going to appoint another one. We can kill the ruling mullah council, but then they're just going to appoint another ruling mullah council, and then they're going to appoint a new Ayatollah. Mm-hmm. And the only solution to that would be, what, like mass conscription of a 10 million man army to go and sack Persia? Come on. Again, we're already $40 trillion in debt. We're not doing a World War II level effort to invade Persia right now. Nobody's saying that. If Donald Trump tried it, he'd be out of power tomorrow. They just call no confidence in the Senate or something, and he'd be gone. We're not doing that. So they had a way to get us into this thing. They have no smart way to get us out of it. And you know what, man? Like, screw everybody's stupid feelings. They could have and they should have admitted that we have no good way to tie up Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And they should have left Afghanistan in 2002 or 5 or 7.
Yes.
Not tripled the war in 9 through 12 and then lost anyway and didn't leave until 21 in humiliating disgrace with hundreds of thousands of people killed on a mission that never could have been accomplished except that people in Washington didn't want to admit it, at least not out loud where anybody could hear them, you know? But meanwhile, everybody knew the truth. We have to cut and run. We will cut and run. As I said in my book, Fool's Errand in 2017, that whether we leave in 10 years or whether we leave in 20 years, it's going to be the exact same thing. The Taliban's going to walk right back into Kabul. Yeah. Can our guys keep them out of Kabul now? Sure. The day we leave, they're going to walk right in.
And that's what happened.
Unavoidable. Same thing here. It's not going to get better. So just admit it and quit it.
Yeah. Scott Horton, always such a pleasure to see you, man. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, John, for having me.
That was Scott Horton. And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember to always seek the truth where you are not allowed to. I'm John Kiriakou. We'll see you next time.